This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
In Jim Shepherd's new collection of short stories, the Massachusetts-based writer takes his readers on quite a journey, from troubled marriages and the world of black ops to high mountain avalanche research in the Swiss Alps to the interior landscape of the 20th century explorer Freya Stark. His short stories are about some very big subjects. They compress history, conflict, and personal questing into tight narratives. He uses the first-person voice, taking on and inhabiting a variety of personalities, first-person identities, and points of view. This is Shepherd's fourth collection of stories, and it's called You Think That's Bad. And Jim Shepherd, thanks so much for being on Radio Boston.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, the titles of your books don't often give much of a hint of what they're about. Your previous award-winning collection was called Like You'd Understand Anyway. It seemed to sort of taunt the reader. Where did this current title, You Think That's Bad, come from?
The previous title, and it had some sort of hilarious side effects. Like, my students' parents would say to them things like, so what's your professor's book called? And they would say, Like You'd Understand Anyway. And their parents would go, well, I might understand. You don't know. This collection is so much more preoccupied with catastrophe, both global and personal, that You Think That's Bad seemed a good way of pulling everything together.
So let's talk about a couple of the stories. I wanted to start with actually the first story, Minotaur. It tells the story of two men who work for the Department of Defense. They're involved in secret military work, black ops, and they're sort of obsessed by it. And they have troubled domestic relationships at home with their partners. Can you talk a little bit about this? What inspired this story?
I came across kind of a wonderful book on patches for black ops operators. And the paradox of that seemed to me absolutely wonderful and psychologically telling. These are locked down, absolutely secret organizations, but nevertheless, they want to have completely mysterious patches on their uniforms so that people will know they're involved in something, but they can't be told what that is. I think the title of the book was something like, I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you, or something like that. And again, it went right to that preoccupation I have with people who want to communicate and at the same time don't want to communicate.
Now, didn't one of the characters have one of these patches and one of his partners looking at it?
Oh, yeah, there's a number of those patches. And in fact, I think one of them says, and this is a real patch, that the ultimate Black Ops patch was from a unit that stayed in a place called Point Mugu, and that patch was simply a black-on-black circle.
So it seems like one of the ideas that plays out here is this world of military Black Ops exacts a price. It's secretive, it's out of sight, of course it's bloody, it's deadly, and in the same way, your characters who are involved in it are sort of holding on to their secrets, which seems to be exacting a bit of a price on a toll on their relationships.
Yeah, I'm always interested in the way we justify to ourselves the kind of damage we do in interpersonal relationships, and in this case, of course, these men are trained in a kind of super secrecy, and they take an enormous masculine pride in that super secrecy. And of course, then that spills over into their private lives.
Mm. It's a powerful story. Another one I wanted to ask you about is Track of the Assassins. This sort of delves into the life of Freya Stark, the famous 20th century explorer. Can you read a little from that? I was going to ask you to read the second paragraph on page 19. It paints such a wonderful image of her world, her upbringing, her parents, and her mother.
Okay, I'd love to. Our mother's parents had settled in Italy at the time of the Risorgimento, when Tuscany was attracting all varieties of expatriates. She liked to explain that they'd enjoyed such a thriving salon that as a little girl she had found herself at one affair accompanied on the piano by Franz Liszt. She described herself as more of an enthusiast for projects than for children, and would regale the room with the story of how, having brought me home from the hospital, she'd been dismayed to discover she'd made no provision for my food, my clothes, or my sleeping. By the time Vera was born, a year later, our parents had moved to the pretty hill town of Asolo, and my sister later remarked from her sickbed how much of our childhood had been spent watching adults pack or unpack great trunks. It had only been a small surprise then, when our mother left us to join the Count de Rocio, in order, she said, to partner in his philanthropic enterprise of providing employment for the area encompassing his family's provincial seat. Later, she'd had us join them in their home, and, filled with happiness herself, had never noticed that our lives were heaped about in miniature ruins.
I love that. I love it. Her mother, dismayed to discover she'd made no provision for my food, my clothes, or my sleeping. That's such a lovely image and such a wonderful image of a world. What inspired you to become Freya Stark in this story?
I had been reading some of Freya's travel literature, some of which is pretty wonderful. And what will often happen in a case like that is I'll come across a moment that snags my interest in emotional terms. I mean, whenever I'm reading this kind of stuff in objective terms, it's very clearly a good story. It's just a matter of whether or not emotionally something seems wonderfully congruent with where I am at any given moment. And at one point she described herself, and I put this phrase in the story, as a solitary and fierce believer in independence who was prone to fixation on others. And I thought, what a wonderfully self-defeating way to be. And here she is, this British woman who learned everything there was to know at that point about Arabic, about Persian, about the Quran. She was self-taught in the most wonderfully comprehensive way and absolutely fearless in that way British explorers can be. But that combination of truly admirable courageousness and anthropological curiosity on the one hand and a real oblivious imperial sense that the world is your playground on the other. That paradox fascinates me, I think.
Well, I wanted to ask you about how, as a writer, you're known as a bit of a shapeshifter. You know, when you write these stories in the first person, you take on so convincingly these characters, whether it's Freya Stark or the Black Ops folks or a 15th century French nobleman or a serial killer. How do you settle on these characters and how do you go about inhabiting their characters and their voices?
Well, once I've decided that, in fact, something in this story is persistently engaging my interest, what I'll start to do is immerse myself in first person and primary sources as much as I can to see if, in fact, I'm starting to feel as though I can ventriloquize those voices. And sometimes that happens sooner in the process than at other times, and sometimes it doesn't work at all.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, an example of a voice that you were sort of noodling around with that you just couldn't sort of come to terms with and you had to discard.
I'm happy you brought up the subject of failure because nothing cheers me more than that. I've had all sorts of failures, but the most common type is the sort I had maybe a year or two ago. I was researching Charles Lindbergh, and I thought, well, he's a no-brainer for somebody like me. He had an extraordinarily eventful life. The detail about Lindbergh that snagged my attention was that he had been unable to sleep two full nights before his transatlantic flight, which meant that he was going to be up a third night all by himself without really a window to look out forward. And he had to figure out a way of keeping himself awake for the, I think it was a 15-hour flight or something like that. And he settled on the strategy of talking to himself in a very loud voice for 15 hours. And I thought, well, I can relate to that. And so I started researching him. And I felt as though I was getting to know him quite well. But the more I felt like I was getting to know him, the less I felt that Venn diagram that I would draw, sort of an overlap between Jim and overlap between the subject, was starting to please me. It felt as though those spheres were moving farther and farther apart. So I ended up thinking that I didn't find him a baffling figure at all, but I also didn't find him a figure that I was particularly empathizing with, and so I just stopped the project. At least I can say to myself that I enjoyed what I was reading anyway.
Sure. You know, you mentioned the research that you do, and You Think That's Bad has three pages of acknowledgments at the end that cites more than 60 books and articles. So obviously you spend a lot of time researching. How do you strike a balance there? I mean, when you're writing fiction, when do you know that you know enough?
The key, I think, is understanding that knowing enough means having enough of the illusion in your head that you can begin the process of stepping forward into this essentially imagined world. And, of course, the big danger with writing that way is that writers are such geniuses at procrastination that you will say to yourself, well, if I'm writing about the Soviet Union, I can't begin until I'm an expert on the Soviet Union, which means you'll die before you begin.
That's right. That'll take the next 25 years.
Exactly. Yeah. So what you do, I think, is you say to yourself, at some point, there's going to be enough pressure to begin that you're going to step forward without having really turned yourself into an expert on this at all. Much the same way, if you were really anxious to go somewhere and I started giving you directions, you might say, okay, yeah, I think I got it. I'm going to head and go to that neighborhood and I hang a left and then I'll ask directions once I get there, essentially. And you sort of set off before you're entirely ready. But it's really crucial you do that, not only to get moving, but also because it's the setting off, actually, that's going to tell you what else you need to know.
As we know, writers are often told, aspiring writers are often told, write what you know. But in your writing, you seem to plumb so deeply the lives of others. So what do you tell your students? You teach literature, film, creative writing at Williams College. Do you tell them to write what they know, or do you sort of present yourself as
the model? I tell them to write what they're passionate about, and I tell them that if they choose to write about, say, what it's like to be a nun in 17th century France, as opposed to what it's like to be a young boy in a dorm at Williams College, then they have the responsibility to go out and learn something about it so that they would actually persuade me that they've tried to engage that world. I don't find anything objectionable about somebody coming in and saying, you know, I want to write about another century and another mindset. I find it an insult to that place and time if they come in and say, I didn't want to read anything about it. I just figured they were just like me, you know, and suddenly this nun sounds exactly like somebody who's in a fraternity at Alabama or something like that. You know.
Some of your stories and make me want to ask this question about historical fiction, which is usually the domain of the novel. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about the short story and condensing the form into this short story. What do you like about that?
I like the sort of guerrilla warfare elements of the short story as opposed to sort of the massed armies of a novel, to extend the analogy. I like the idea of getting in fast, doing what you want to do, and getting out again. I also like the reader's sort of gathering comprehension of the paradox of, wow, this is a lot of information and not very many pages, essentially. I have a lot of novelist friends who have seen the sort of folders of research and have said, you're crazy. You know, you could get a big, fat novel out of this. And I say to them, yeah, but I like reaching many fewer people and making much less money.
That's true. Why would you want to do a novel and write?
Why would you want to do a novel when I don't just give you all these readers and money and things like that? but again, I very much like, if you're able to do it, the kind of intensity that accrues around being dropped into that world, feeling as though you actually have found your footing and then having something startling or revelatory or sufficiently consciousness enlarging happen, and then the world leaves you, essentially, and you're ready for another engagement.
Well, Jim Shepherd, it's a great collection of stories. Thanks so much for coming in to talk about it. Jim Shepherd is the author of 3 novels and 4 short story collections. His latest short story collection is called You Think That's Bad. You can find an excerpt from it, as well as information about Jim Shepherd's upcoming Boston area readings on our website, radioboston.org.
Well, that's it for today. Monday on Radio Boston, it will be Memorial Day, so we visit the World War II Museum in Natick. 6,000 artifacts, from Nazi uniforms to American bazookas to a Sherman tank, and a passion to keep the past alive.
My daughter asked me, she said, Daddy, do you believe in ghosts? And I said, absolutely. I said, my museum is full of ghosts. I preserve the lives of people. I preserve what they did. So this place is full of ghosts.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com.
Our show is produced by Adam Ragusea, Jessica Alpert, Dan Mazzi, Jason Breslow, and Rachel Gottbaum.
Jeremy Bernfeld is our web producer. Tim Skog is our technical director.
The executive producer of Radio Boston is Mark Navin.
And before we go today, we want to say goodbye and thank you to Anna Pinkert, who's been our wonderful, exuberant, and helpful intern for the past several months. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you so much, Anna. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend, and join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.